Hello, this is Melissa, and it is Real History on the 17th of October, 2024. And I am really excited today to be joined by Dr. David A. Hughes. I have been talking about him to you for a few weeks, and I thought we were going to do this as a video call. So I combed my hair for nothing. But we're not able to do that today, so that is all right. And I just wanted to give a brief introduction. Like I say, I've been telling you about him for a little while now, and I encouraged you all to watch the excellent presentation that happened on the 21st of September, the OmniWar Symposium, that was hosted and moderated by Catherine Austin Fitz. Dr. Hughes has a doctorate in German history from Duke University in the U.S. He also has a doctorate in international relations from Oxford University. He has written two books. I have just finished reading the first half of the first book. I should say I almost finished it. I'm on chapter 8, which is the final chapter, and it's The Coming Unrest. It's really good. And that book is COVID-19, Psychological Operations and the War for Technocracy. That was published in April of 2024. I understand that there was about a 10-month delay in getting that published. And so just a few months later, in June of this year, he published through Skyhorse, Wall Street, the Nazis, and the Crimes of the Deep State. I am not sure how Dr. Hughes came to my attention, but I was pleased to discover his work, because those of you who've been listening to me for a while understand that since Alan passed away, I have had a difficult time finding voices that I think make sense, that are saying the things that I think that should be discussed right now. And so I mentioned to Dr. Hughes, oh, yes, I have a couple of quibbles here and there with maybe how you're arriving at something or the history or so forth. But the important thing is that he understands very well that we are in a war. He has come up with the term omni-war to describe this. And so longtime listeners to Alan are going to know that we have been in a war for a long time, and it is intensifying. And so without a further introduction, hello, how are you, David?
I'm very well, thanks, Melissa. Thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's so nice to be speaking with you.
Likewise.
So I never feel as prepared as I want to be to have these conversations, but I've given it a really good go here. I read the first book, and I also read your four-part co-written series on transhumanism that you did with Lisa Johnson and Daniel Brody. Very excellent. And some of the things that you wrote about did come up in the OmniWar Symposium. And I heard in an interview that I was listening to recently of yours that your first kind of foray into this was an article that you wrote on, let's see if I have it here because I don't have it typed up, COVID-19 Vaccines for Children in the UK, A Tale of Establishment Corruption. And I believe that was written in February of 2022 for the International Journal of Vaccine Theory Practice. Tell us, if you will, what you thought during the early days of COVID, and what prompted you to take a closer look and eventually write that article?
Okay, well, firstly, thank you very much for the levels of preparation that you've undertaken. It's a lot of reading, to be sure, so I'm grateful for that. In terms of the early days of COVID, in some ways, I was like everybody else. I now realize that it was a shock and awe operation, particularly in the spring of 2020. And so along with most other people, I was kind of knocked sideways in many respects. Nevertheless, I did have my suspicions very early on from the moment that the UK Coronavirus Act was passed on the 23rd of March 2020. A very, very long piece of legislation, hundreds of sides long, obviously took time to prepare. Matt Hancock even said it had taken months to prepare. So how did they know to prepare this thing? And straight away, it reminded me of the USA Patriot Act, which was all ready to go as soon as 9/11 happened. So I did see certain parallels there. When it came to the summer of 2020, and in the UK, even the official data was telling us that case rates and mortality rates were very low, even approaching zero in terms of mortality rates officially. And then they rolled out the mask mandates. I knew that there was something very badly wrong there, and that really did get me at a very visceral level. From the very beginning, I had absolute contempt for these mask mandates. And that was the moment at which I decided to begin writing in earnest about this and to begin doing very extensive research, the fruits of which have largely been seen this year. It did strike me that there was a multi-level psychological operation taking place, and that's what I present in volume one here of COVID-19 psychological operations and the war for technocracy. And then, of course, as time went on, it became increasingly evident that the authorities were trying to use all means possible to coerce people into taking injections containing novel technologies with no long-term safety data. This was very, very nefarious. And I think the darkest point for me was when they came for the children. It's one thing to try and make a public health rationale in terms of allegedly vaccinating older people and so on, but to systematically work the way down the age ranges and then get to children who were at no risk from the virus. And you know, the risk reward ratio of taking one of these products was very unfavorable, to say the least. And I also have children of my own and was deeply worried at the time that they would come for my children as well. So that was the point that I wrote the article that you mentioned about COVID-19 vaccines for children in the UK. And in that article, I make the case that there never was any sound scientific or ethical or moral justification for the rollout of the vaccines to children. And from there, my output has only grown.
Backing up a little bit from that, I am very curious about what you've come to understand about the operation that happened on 9/11, because you have written about this, and I think it helped prepare your mind. Did you see what you saw about 9/11 before COVID?
Yes. So for me, my wake-up moment, in inverted commas, came in December 2016, when I first thought to ask some critical questions about the events of 9/11. And it only took about an hour of research for me to understand very clearly that the public had been lied to about what took place on that day. Anybody with a shred of intellectual integrity and a relatively basic understanding of vectors and maths and physics and so on can see very clearly that the Twin Towers were not destroyed through a gravity-driven collapse caused by 19 Muslim hijackers flying planes into the buildings, and nor was a third building destroyed by only two planes. I then spent the next several years looking ever more deeply into 9/11 and was really shocked by everything that I discovered. The extent of the deception. But what it means, of course, is that the way power works in the world is nothing like what the public has been led to believe. The fact that all governments, seemingly, and all mainstream media outlets are continuing to act in a coordinated manner to enforce the official account of events, which is patently false, This has all the hallmarks of totalitarianism and the big lie methodology. So when we get to COVID, we see this on an even larger scale. Extremely close levels of cooperation by the authorities transnationally. And again, to push through narratives which were demonstrably fraudulent. I get into the deception aspect in chapter 6 of my book, which is titled Weaponized Deception. And there I argue that pretty much everything that the public was told about COVID-19, in inverted commas, was in fact false. And so this is the world that we live in, where power is premised on deceit and every means possible is used to coerce citizens and deceive citizens into believing the lies. And in that context, as an academic at the time, it seemed to me that the first obligation of academia should be to defend the truth, particularly when lies are being used for very evil purposes. Unfortunately, however, it does seem to me that academia has been a essential part of the cover-up, and I demonstrated that really through my own research when I managed to publish an article in 2020 in a respected mainstream peer-reviewed academic journal titled The 9/11 Truth and the Silence of the IR Discipline. And in that paper, I asked, why is it that academics refuse to examine the evidence regarding the events of 9/11, particularly when so much rests on the correct interpretation of those events and the war on terror and so on, all premised on that particular narrative. And I was hoping that that would stimulate some meaningful discussion and debate within academia. And on the positive side, the article has been read tens of thousands of times, even though it's behind a paywall, which to me suggests that it's mostly academics reading it, because it would be university libraries that would be providing access to the article. However, virtually no discussion of the article at all within academia. Here we are over 4.5 years later. It's had maybe 2 or 3 citations in that entire period, none of them to actually engage with the substance of the article. And so that demonstrated something very sinister to me, that there is something about the way power works in the world whereby an entire profession worldwide will bury its head in the sand and not even look at the evidence, not even ask the questions. I'm not trying to claim that I have a correct interpretation of what happened or anything of that nature. I'm simply saying at least look at the evidence, ask the questions and have a rational debate and discussion around them. And yet academia won't do that. And so it's very, very disturbing.
Let me ask you a question about what was going on in your thinking in 2016 that prompted you to take a closer look. Why did you do that?
I was teaching a class at the time on US foreign policy, and I was reflecting on some of the parallels between the Vietnam War and the war in Afghanistan. And so both wars were very long. Both wars were very costly. Both wars involved a lot of PTSD for the troops involved. And as I reflected more and more on the various parallels, I thought back to 1964 and the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which served as the pretext for the major US military escalation in Vietnam, particularly to do with airstrikes. And I thought, well, we now know that the Gulf of Tonkin was a lie. It never really happened. There's not much dispute about that. And so, you know, what got the war on terror going? And the war in Afghanistan, well, that was 9/11. And, you know, surely that's not a lie, right? Right? Hold on a minute. I better just check that. Because I know that there are these crazy conspiracy theorists who claim that there's something a bit unusual about that. And as I mentioned before, it really only took an hour of actually just looking at the videos with my own eyes, with an open mind, and the scales fell from my eyes.
Mm. Well, that's very powerful. And that is very powerful. Now, there is something, I may be skipping all over the place here, but there is something in your presentation and also the work that you have done with Lissa Johnson and Daniel Brody that supposes, the supposition is, if enough people can be made aware of inconsistencies or things that don't add up, then they might be able to take the leap into understanding where we're going, this omni-war, the transhumanism, the technocracy. And yet my observation of years of participating in this at some level or another is that human minds don't seem to work that way. Unfortunately, for some people who have something in them, some curiosity, there's something in them that allows them to eventually see some aspect. And then, as you say, the scales fall off their eyes. But unfortunately, the vast majority of people, their minds don't seem to work that way. Allen would have described that the indoctrination was scientifically perfected and it works perfectly on most people.
Well, the question is this an inherent characteristic of human nature that can never be altered? Or does it reflect the success of propaganda and psychological operations, which have become ever more sophisticated over the course of approximately 100 years? And I would venture that, you know, really, I mean, looking at Allen's lifetime, for example, you know, if we were to look at, say, you know, a 40 or 50 year period, going back into the 1970s or 1980s or even earlier, perhaps, most of the public had no idea about the extent of the deception or the way in which the media was being used to condition public opinion. Many people would automatically believe everything that the television told them. There were a limited number of news channels. We're told all the time that we live in democracies and, you know, the greatest country on earth and all of this kind of thing, and we should be so proud. And again, you know, who at the time would have thought to question, for instance, the moon landings? I mean, you know, nobody makes up a lie on that scale, right? It's not possible to do, except, in my opinion at least, the mountains of evidence that have since come out indicate that that too was a deception. And then we get to 9/11, and for many people, still a minority, of course, within society, they did understand that something was wrong. And I think at the time, there was a temptation to think, oh, well, the truth will set us free, right? We can see that we were lied to. And if we can kind of expose this, then everything will be made good again, and somehow magically we'll be free. And of course, that's not what happened. For many reasons. And firstly, the truth by itself isn't enough because of the ongoing psychological operations. And as a very simple example, the term conspiracy theorist is enough in most cases to close down rational discussion and debate. And most people have been conditioned, like Pavlov's dogs, to just bark the term conspiracy theorist, and that's the end of the conversation. So it's amazing how powerful this can be. And of course, the other element of this is that even if you do bring the truth out, and even if you do take cases to court, as Judy Wood did with her Keytam case relating to 9/11, it won't go anywhere because the entire power structure is corrupt and the entire power structure is working against the interests of the people. But then we get to COVID, And I think this has been a major wake-up event for an ever-increasing number of people, because unlike previous kind of methods of operating, which often take place over the course of decades, it's very slow and incremental change so that the public doesn't notice, you know, that there's something big going on. Well, with 2020, who wouldn't notice that there was, you know, shocking things were taking place? And I think that what we're seeing now is an accelerating awakening, for want of a better term. And I'm not convinced that there's something necessarily flawed, perhaps, in human nature, which means that people will never wake up, or it'll always be like this, or, you know, or maybe it has something to do with sinfulness or whatever. I think that there are reasons for hope now, that as more and more people do wake up, and once you wake up, you can't go back to sleep again. You can't unsee these things.
That's true.
That public perception is now starting to shift. And the final thing I'll say on this is that objectively, if you accept my argument that we are now in an omni-war whose purpose on the part of the oppressors is biodigital control, subjugation, and ultimately enslavement of the human race, then the human race has too much to lose now. It can't afford to stay asleep. It can't afford to keep resorting to the lazy conspiracy theory slur and so on. Things are much too serious now. And so I think the objective conditions will also contribute to the awakening and the resistance.
Well, that is an optimistic outlook. I just going back a little bit, I think one of the things that Alan would point to, and I'm not sure that he ever said this on air, but he certainly said it to me, referring back to Paul's writing in the Christian Bible, when Paul referred to some people as creatures of instinct. There were other examples that Alan gave, but in other words, that maybe not all humans are cut from the same cloth. And this isn't, I won't get into sinful nature, or is man essentially good, or is he born bad? But the idea that there are people who all down through time exist for more or less sense satisfaction. And those are people that, I don't know. I mean, I've even wondered, are they soulless? Is that possible? And I don't want to get too far out, but I do think that humans have been tampered with by a priesthood down through time that's known how to control. It's like, you know, you've got the priests who say, well, you're going to have to give us a heart now and again, or the sun's not going to come out, right? You know, this control of this understanding of the elements and this understanding of nature that a priestly class has always wanted to keep control of as a way of dominating people who don't understand that. The Arthur C. Clarke, you know, things can look magic, like magic, if you don't understand what's going on, if you don't understand the science behind it. So that was my point there. But it also, I mean, I'll just mention that the first book that Alan wrote, it was volume one of the Cutting Through books. This was 1999, and it was the androgynous hermaphroditic agenda. And he demonstrates in this book this priestly class and what the material is. He said the rebuilding of Solomon's temple is the physical rebuilding of man. And we get this in the Masonic ideas that they're perfecting that which was left imperfect. But his point was that we were hijacked a long time ago. These are not recent captures of our institutions. And in academia, one book that I don't know if you've read this or not, but Foundations, Their Power and Influence.
No, I'm not familiar with that one.
It's an excellent book. It came out of the Rees Commission that happened in the U.S. in the 1950s. It was brought to the attention of Congress that private foundations had undue influence in academia, the media, et cetera, et cetera. And it turned out that this Rees Commission in, I think, the early 50s, because this book was written in 57, they cited back a similar congressional panel that had happened in the 30s, where it was the same kind of concern. Big money funds foundations, and those foundations fund basically everything that you see in academia. And I think this is one of the reasons why you've looked at 9/11 and started to question it, and there's been very little, if any, response from your fellow academics.
Yeah, as a result of my experience, I've got quite a long piece, about 25,000 words or so, nearing completion, which is reflecting on precisely this fascinating but also terrifying sociological question of how academia worldwide remains silent on certain taboo topics, which it is nevertheless essential to broach, because it really gives the lie to ideas about academic freedom and so on. And it is actually a very complex picture, but at the center of it, as you say, are the major foundations in particular. And it's extraordinary, the influence, for example, of the Rockefeller Foundation. I'm reading Jacob Nordangard's book, Rockefeller Controlling the Game, at the moment. And I knew a great deal about the Rockefellers already, but when you see the extent of the influence across all areas of society, you realize to a very large degree over the last 100 or more years just how much of our world has been shaped by really a small handful of extremely, extremely powerful actors. And I used to teach international relations, and a few years ago I started looking into the origins of that subject discipline. And it only really became formalized as its own separate discipline with its own brand of theory in the 1950s as a result of a conference that had been organized by, guess who? The Rockefellers. I just thought, this is unbelievable. You know, I was aware about the kind of Carnegie Rockefeller influence on medicine and history and so on. But it seems to be pretty much everywhere you turn. And so what we have now in academia is a system whereby knowledge production really follows money and power more than it follows the truth. And in the UK, for example, academic posts are very difficult to get. And when you've got one, your career progression is very much determined by your ability to attract external research funding, largely because so much money has been drained out of the system in various ways. But what this means, therefore, is that academic knowledge production is skewed very much towards research grants and putting in bids and so on. And that then allows these powerful foundations and trusts and government funding organizations to really control the narrative and what gets funded and what doesn't get funded. And it's a very powerful control mechanism. Meanwhile, at the fringes, you know, when you have, I don't know, somebody like Professor David Miller, formerly at the University of Bristol, when he is bravely speaking out and openly challenging Zionism and the Jewish lobby and this kind of thing, the Jewish lobby was successful in getting him fired. He's since won a legal case in his favor, but there are very nasty smear tactics that start to come in. We have a professor at the University of Edinburgh in the UK called Tim Haywood, doing fantastic work around propaganda and really exposing a lot of the way Anglo-American propaganda operations work. Well, recently he appeared again on the front page of the Times, I think it might have been, and yet another hit piece essentially calling for his job. And now, who wants to operate under those conditions? And a new tactic they seem to have developed is to get students to make complaints, however unfounded, against professors. And it's, you know, it becomes quite nasty. And so, you know, for the average academic, who wants to deal with any of that? Most academics just want the quiet life. They just want to teach and enjoy their research. So, you know, why not just, you know, it's easier, isn't it, to kind of align with power. But the trouble we've got now is that the world is in such a dire place because these lies have been allowed to flourish that I think academia really needs to face up to what's going on.
I think you're absolutely right. One of the scary things, now I am with you that we are in this push where we have to, each one of us with whatever our skills and abilities are, we've got to come out and do something or say something. And we all have different talents, but they have to be put to use. One of the things that has been difficult for me since the beginning of what I call it Operation C. Now, I'll just say that this will be, what goes up on YouTube here of our conversation will be heavily edited, or I may just put a trailer up and guide them to other outlets because I have to self-censor so much there. Everything, you know, I've got the big V and the little V and Operation C because the censorship is intense there on Google. I think that one thing that started to actually frighten me during COVID was how well orchestrated the internal divisions amongst dissidents was. So things would splinter off into bizarre conspiracies or things. It became really important if you did not believe in the 5G nano, the graphene connection, then you were obviously controlled opposition. If you hadn't looked at that yet, what was wrong with you? And then there was the no virus avenue that, you know, germ theory and Pasteur was a 33rd degree Mason. You know, it just got very weird. And it became scary to me because I thought this is it. This is everything certainly that Alan was warning about for 25 years had come to pass. And you could see technocracy stepping up as the system. You could see everything was telling us we're going into a credit system. We're going to be monitored. This is going to be bio-digital. They've told us this. They've written about it. Why are people fighting about such odd little things? And if you want to call it a dissident movement, but people who should be seeing what's going on. And then I began to see a lot of controlled opposition. And was it everyone that I thought controlled? I don't know, but it becomes discouraging. And it was one of the reasons why I was relieved to stumble on your work and the work of Daniel Brody and Lisa Johnson and to see that, you get it. You really see what's at stake here.
Yeah, the so-called controlled opposition element of this is very important and in some ways goes back to, say, 2009 and Cass Sunstein and Adrian Vermeule's paper calling for, what did they call them, cognitive infiltration of 9/11 truth groups. So that's actually in the published literature, deploying state agents, they said, to anonymously enter chat rooms and find various ways of disrupting. And that's exactly what we saw in the 9/11 truth movement. And this really is the value of Andrew Johnson's two books, 9/11 Finding the Truth and 9/11 Holding the Truth, because he features a whole cast of characters in those two books who are evidently untrustworthy and were evidently involved in subverting the so-called truth movement in various ways. And they were very successful because that so-called movement quickly became no such thing. It became splintered and fractured and full of infighting and bitterness and, you know, kind of nonsense theories trying to, you know, compete against more serious kind of arguments. And that's before you get to the kind of major propaganda operations against figures like Judy Wood, you know, just persistent for years, designed to smear and discredit and, you know, claim that she's crazy and all of this kind of thing. So this is why it gets really, really hard actually to get to the truth. And this year, in the context of what's been happening since 2020, I've coined what I call my three camps of awareness framework. And so for any of your listeners who are have not heard me say this before, just quickly, camp one is essentially mainstream narratives and everything that the governments and politicians and the mainstream media tell you. And sadly, it seems to be what the majority of society believes. Camp two is for those who have doubts about camp one. And it's quite difficult to get out of camp one into camp two because just psychologically, you've got to abandon a lot of kind of key things that you've been taught your whole life to believe. You know, the inherent kind of goodness of our civilization and our society and the strength of our democracy and all of this goes out the window. And so a minority of people make it into camp two, but unfortunately they are greeted there by a battalion, and I use that military term advisedly, a battalion of fake dissidents and fake heroes whose job is to win their trust and ultimately lead them nowhere.
Yes.
And then we have camp three, which is the truth. And it's a very ugly,
small camp.
Very difficult place to be. And if it's hard enough getting out of camp one into camp two, it's even harder, I think, getting out of camp two and into camp three. And you find the camp two figures, you know, that their names tend to be very well known. They're not censored. They're not shadow banned. They have hundreds of thousands, if not millions of followers. They're typically doing very well for themselves. They're flown all over the world on this kind of international tour circuit. They write an unfeasible number of, substacks and tweets and all the rest of it. It's obviously a coordinated operation. Camp three, you've probably never heard of most of the figures in camp three. They have no reach. They have just, you know, hundreds or perhaps a few thousand followers and subscribers. It's a tricky place to be. Now, the realization that I personally have come to in the last few months is that relative to camp two, camp three is tiny, and that actually most people in camp two, be they bad actors or just people who have been taken in by the bad actors, vastly outnumber those in camp three. And so it's been quite interesting to me, for example, to look at the number of views and downloads that my COVID book has had on the publisher's website. And we're up to 120,000 now since April. So it's averaging 20,000 views a month just on the publisher's website. You know, that's without it being shared in many other places all across the internet for free. And so it's evident that large numbers of people have taken an interest in my book, but it's a bit like my 9/11 article. Who's actually talking about it? And when you think about all of the well-known figures in camp two, the kind of very public dissidents who you come across straight away when you start asking questions, how many of them have even mentioned my book? You know, I'm not trying to claim that, you know, I should, you know, have some kind of special right to, you know, attract attention or anything of that nature. But the fact is, it's a substantial piece of work. There's nothing else out there like it in terms of the kind of academic rigor that's been applied in a very critical way to these questions. And you would have thought that it would provide a lot of ammunition for serious critics of the COVID narrative. But it seems that no Camp 2 figure wants to touch it. So it's very revealing.
It is very revealing. And I must say this now or I will forget to. COVID-19, Psychological Operations and the War for Technocracy, Volume 1, which is what is currently available. I have linked to this several times. I have encouraged people to go and download it for free from your Substack, and I know that some of my listeners have. But I want to say now that this is an excellent primer. It is going to walk people through the history of how we got here. It's going to give you good, succinct, concise talking points so that you can share this with other people. There's humor in there. There's lots of thought-provoking references that you give, and you pulled it all together really well. And I just think it's like 101 in psychological operations, essential reading.
Thanks. And the key thing about it really is the amount of evidence that it presents, and virtually every sentence includes a reference, so you can check all of the sources for yourself. And I don't for 1 minute expect everybody to agree with everything that I've written, but it's certainly a credible, well-structured, well-presented piece of academic work. And wherever you're at in terms of your journey along the path of understanding what's been happening in 2020, I think you'll find a lot in the book that you perhaps didn't know, and some of it really truly shocking when we get to some of the more evil aspects of the operation and what was done to the public transnationally in 2020-2021.
Mm-hmm. It's well marked up. I printed it out and then bound it so it would be easy for me to look at and, you know, read anywhere I happen to be. But I made multiple marks and notations where things that you referenced and cited, Alan Watt repeatedly dropped, you know, Club of Rome, what, you know, I could just go on and on with things that you've brought into this that he's talked about for years. But I also made as many marks and notes about things that were new to me that I hadn't seen, or you really got into the Rockefellers, for instance, with new information there that I hadn't seen. So it's well worth the effort of reading it. And I know that we don't tend to be readers nowadays, but it's worth the effort. And it doesn't surprise me in the least that No Camp 2 people have jumped on this, because I think that this is the very nature of controlled opposition. Now, if I want to be a little less cynical, I might say that it could be somehow the way it works in academia, where people just know what side the bread is buttered on, and they're not going to go against that. But I'm not naive, and I think that there is actually real coordination in Camp 2 and academia that that is an actual strategy of silencing and shadow banning anyone who's made it to Camp 3.
Yes, and the networks as well of infiltrators in both cases, I think, is important, and these things need to be exposed. And it's been very interesting to me, for example, just recently watching J.J. Cooey.
Yes, I've just gotten into him as well.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, some of what he says, because he was fired from his academic post in 2020 for speaking out against the COVID narrative. And he was a professor of biology. And so some of what he says goes over my head, because I don't have that level of understanding of biology. But what interests me about the stance that he's taken is he's very aggressive in calling out people who he considers to be, in his words, liars and traitors. I mean, you know, very, uh-huh, very strong terms. And he talks all about the networks that are involved and the kind of cross promotion of one another that they do. And this is in some ways quite heartening to see. You know, it's got to be careful not to just kind of come across as, you know, someone who's too angry and just kind of complaining all the time and pointing the finger all the time. But I think he's onto something important there. And similarly, Amazing Polly last year, when she started doing research into the wellness company. And this again was extremely revealing because so many of these Camp 2 figures seem to have ties to that one organization. So, you know, what is the true character of that organization? It has an awful lot of money. You know, it's directors are all paid $10,000 a month and so on. And so is it just a health company? Or are we looking at something else here? Now, the fascinating thing about this is you can often tell when somebody is over the target because of what happens to them. And very nasty things happened to Amazing Polly at that point. And she was doxxed and there were, you know, attacks on her private life and so on. And I know her health has been suffering a bit as well. But for whatever reason, she's much less vocal now and producing much less content than she was before this happened. And so I think anyone who's serious about the pursuit of the truth needs to understand these multiple levels of perception management and narrative control, because it's not as simple as understanding that the mainstream accounts are designed to deceive and for purposes of oppression. You also really need to understand that many of those who are out there claiming to be pushing back and challenging power, speaking truth to power and so on, they themselves are part of the power structure and they themselves are fulfilling quite a deliberate role in terms of manipulating public perception. And this makes the truth very hard to get to.
I took a few swipes here and there, and there was one person in particular. I just decided, you know, I don't want to be sued for multiple millions of dollars, as I saw happened, you know, and you know what I'm talking about.
It's
very ugly.
Yep.
And so you just kind of move your sights somewhere else. And also because I watched Alan do this for years and years, and he talked sometimes obliquely about the Dirty Tricks Squad. He didn't want to go the J.J. Cooey route because he said it starts to sound like sour grapes. But, I mean, I could give countless stories of attacks that we suffered. So this is very real. But one of the things which, you know, I will say because I don't think there's any harm in saying it, but we all – Lissa Johnson and the – I re-listened to her segment of the OmniWars Symposium, and she – made a comment, I can't give it to you verbatim, but it was basically how cognition works, that the emotion comes first and the cognition follows. And she said that in order to harden yourself or ensure that that happens to you less, she said what she's discovered works is accuracy. She calls it accuracy. And how do you get to accuracy is curiosity, scientific. She calls it true scientific curiosity. So you are asking questions. You're curious, and that drives you with humility on a path that allows you to see things without hopefully being so clouded in your emotions. But I do think that what she was talking about there, which evidently in psychology is a known thing that people talk about. That's not my field. But the idea that who of us is really as rational and reasonable as we think we are, who of us arrives at our cognitive awareness free of emotions? Well, probably none of us. So we all have to be careful what we think and why we think it and really examine that, because there is someone pulling the strings. I really liked that the fourth of your transhumanism articles was who's pulling the strings. I can come back to the visual on that in a minute. But someone is pulling the strings here. And I think one of the early figures in the Camp 2 that came out was RFK Jr. And his team did a lot of excellent work, and he made sense. There were some things that he said that nobody else said, and yet I think that a lot of that was because he was authorized to say it. And then he does his, what I would call the expected segue, which is endorsing Trump. To me, this was expected. But what is interesting, I posted something which I didn't quite retract, but I did mention it the following week. I posted an interview with Casey Means and Kelly Means and Tucker Carlson. And I said, oh, this isn't political. It's just good information on our toxic food supply, forever poisons, seed oils, all these things that I know are not good, and I want you to see this. Well, I heard later on in the week a little anecdote that it was Casey and Kelly Means who orchestrated, who engineered the meeting and the kind of political endorsement that RFK Jr. had for Trump. And so the following week, I simply said, okay, I was wrong. Everything is political. Everything. And so now you have someone who was a Camp 2 voice of the people pointing out a lot of the things that we needed to hear in Operation C. And now all he can talk about is forever poisons and seed oils. It's as if COVID never happened. It's as if the man he's endorsing was not behind Operation Warp Speed. I mean, these things are astonishing if you stop and think about it, but they are to be expected with Camp 2 players.
Yes, and RFK Jr., I mean, he's one of the most high-profile among them, and I find it very sad. The Children's Health Defense, in my opinion, has done some fantastic and very important work down the years. I was saying that RFK Jr. and Children's Health Defense, in my eyes, were very commendable when I first really started being exposed to them in 2020, particularly drawing attention to some of the risks of vaccines, for example, and the childhood vaccination schedule in the US. They've recently taken the tour bus around for Vax 3, and so on, drawing attention to some of the dangers of the so-called COVID vaccines. And so I was rather disappointed when he used his original entry into the US presidential race as very quickly as a means of promoting Israel. That to me showed that he was actually no different from any other political candidate in the US for whatever reason, be it the Jewish lobby or whatever. Similar is true in this country. Politicians appear to have to pledge fealty to Israel as well as their own country. So that was a bit disturbing. And then, of course, as you say, you called it. He's joined the Trump team, which is an extraordinary move in many ways. And when you start joining the dots, you have to ask what's really going on here. Because RFK Jr. takes with him a lot of trust and a lot of popular support. And you have to wonder, don't you, what if Trump is elected? What if RFK Jr. Is given a very powerful position in the cabinet? And what if somebody like RFK Jr. is used as a figurehead to promote ongoing vaccine rollouts? Because he doesn't come out and say all vaccines are harmful. He, you know, has a more kind of measured stance on it, and is accepting of certain vaccines. And so what if there is another push for a vaccination at some point over the next 4 or 5 years? And somebody like him, who has won all of this trust over so many years, doing a lot of good work, is then used to flip that when it really matters, persuading millions of people to actually go along with more and more vaccinations. And as far as I'm concerned, since 2020, no vaccine can be trusted.
I think you're absolutely right. And another interesting key player in this is Elon Musk, because he, this is another one who's giving endorsement, and he is has been very vocal in favor of mRNA technology. And not only that, but Tesla owns one of the manufacturing plants for a key element of the mRNA rollout.
Yeah, so, I mean, Musk seems to be another high-profile frontman, doesn't he?
To me, there's no doubt about that. Absolutely, I know he's being held up as the saint of free speech, but his maternal grandfather was one of the highest, like second in command in Canada's Technocracy Inc. So.
Yes. Absolutely. When you understand the history and the deeper agendas, it all becomes quite obvious. And this idea of Musk as a champion of free speech is laughable, really, when you look at X as a platform and the level of algorithmic manipulation and shadow banning and so on that takes place. It's all a bit silly. And of course, he also has his Starlink project, which I discussed in my Omniwar presentation in September. Clearly part of an attempt to make EMF, 5G, 6G, 7G, etc., inescapable all over the world. He has his Neuralink project, which seems to be aimed at normalizing the idea of technological interference with the brain. It seems quite crude in terms of the way it works, kind of fitting a chip into the brain through surgical means. But he himself said in 2017, it doesn't have to be that way. You could also do this, he said, through the arteries. And again, as another aspect of my work, I've looked into the kinds of technologies which have been developed over the last 10 or 15 years. And believe it or not, syringe injectable bio nanotechnology that is capable of self-assembling within the body, crossing the blood-brain barrier, forming neural nets, and communicating with an external network does not seem to be science fiction.
I may have misread this, but I thought that you or Lissa, someone in something that I read, had cited the experiments that had already been done with the neural nets inserted into the body.
Yeah, I mentioned Charles Lieber, for example.
Yes.
He injected, using a syringe, a neural net directly into the brains of rats, where they stayed successfully for at least a year. And that was in 2015. And since then, we have seen DARPA projects involving, for example, a company called Battelle, aiming specifically to create similar kind of things for humans, but again, through syringe injectable means, not directly into the brain, but peripherally. And when you put all of this together, it's very, very troubling, because this is what's available in the open literature. When you look at the literature on the internet of bio nano things since 2015, that's a very large literature which talks all about using intracorporeal nanotechnology to create networks which are capable of communicating, possibly via a device like a smartwatch or something, capable of communicating with the internet. And this is all part of a long-standing agenda going back to the year 2000, roughly, to connect human bodies to the internet. It's the ultimate means of social control, if it can be achieved. Now, to most people, this sounds like sci-fi. It sounds completely preposterous and unbelievable. But the reason I'm doing the kind of work I am is to demonstrate that it is by no means science fiction, that there are all kinds of technologies which are already available and have been for some years. And these are just the ones that we know about. When you then factor in the history of classified military research dating back to the Manhattan Project during World War II, we also know that classified military technology leads the openly available science and technology by years. During the Cold War, about 5 to 7 years on average, when you look at things like the U-2 spy plane or the Blackbird jet and so on. Possibly, it now leads public understanding and awareness even more. So when you look at the destruction of the Twin Towers, it would appear that classified military technology was involved in their destruction. I argue this in my piece called In Defense of Judy Wood on my Substack, dhughes.substack.com. And if that's the case, that technology has successfully been concealed for decades now. So when you put all of this together and you look at the long-standing plans to create this internet of bodies, and you look at the technologies that are known, and you consider the black technologies as well, and then you encounter an operation designed to inject as many people as possible worldwide with unknown novel technologies, you have to start asking very serious questions about what is really going on here. And I make the case in my COVID book that none of it was really about public health. The whole thing was really a military operation.
Yes, you make that point well, and I agree. There were a couple of things too that you were just talking about that I wanted to highlight. In your first piece on transhumanism, this is entitled, and I will link to all of this, it's entitled Bringing Transhumanism Down to Earth, Part 1, Military Intelligence Operations Cloaked in the False Promise of Transcendence. You mentioned the Harvard historian Peter Galison and what his comments on classified science being somewhere between 5 to 10 times greater than the science research that is available to civilians or lay people without clearance. And Alan Watt often made the assertion that we have three levels of science. There is the science that's given to us or at academic levels, and then there's military classified science, and then there's even science higher than that, you know, which we can extrapolate out, but it's, you'd have to have incredible clearance to have access to that. So I think it's a given that they're much further ahead on this. And I also wanted to just go here to your comment on Musk's role in popularizing this. Because that's all I think he's doing. You know, when Alan first started talking about the brain chip 25 years ago, it was a crude thing. We're now so advanced that the idea of brain-computer interface is incredibly sophisticated and subtle. And how this can be implanted into our bodies may not need any kind of surgical procedure at all. And when you think about aerosolized vaccine technology, it might not even need to be an injection from a syringe. And then in the second installment of this is entitled Transhumanist Features Part 2, Humanity in the Crosshairs. And I just wanted to point this out to listeners. Again, these intersections here between your work and the things that Alan's brought for years. You cite a paper, The Societal Implications of Nanoscience and Nanotechnology from the year 2000. And that document has been on the Cutting Through the Matrix website for decades. It's since it came out or the website was built. And there is another one from, I think, 2004, which was a presentation given at Loyola University. And at that time, Newt Gingrich spoke there. I don't have the title up in front of me, but it's on the website. And he was basically saying, we are there with this technology. It just needs to be popularized and basically rolled out to the people at the right time. And that was 2004.
Absolutely. And the military has its fingerprints all over this early technology. And at that time, they weren't talking about public health. The public health narrative really only comes in, I would say, 2010, 2012, something like this. And what Lissa Johnson, Daniel Brody and I try to do in our work on transhumanism is to bring out the marketing aspects, if you like, means of sanitizing atrocity, means of rendering technologies which are intended for purposes ultimately of subjugation and human enslavement in a fashion that will be acceptable to the public. And so if you can dress these things up in medicine or healthcare terms, for example, that helps to sell it. So they often talk about potential cures for cancer or for Alzheimer's or for Parkinson's and so on. The transhumanist ideas, crazy as some of them sound, are always very positive. They talk about augmenting and enhancing and upgrading human beings so that we become more than our natural biology and we become in some way superhuman because we're merging with machines. But this is only ever presented as a good thing or even an inevitable thing. If you look at the writings of Ray Kurzweil, as technological progress just inexorably accelerates towards the singularity in 2025. You know, we can't stop it. It's good. It's all for the benefit of humanity. And there's obviously a kind of eugenics aspect in there as well in terms of directing the course of human evolution and making us better than we are by birth. This all seems to us to be one immense smokescreen camouflage decoy for what's really going on here and the real military and social control agendas behind it all. And so I would encourage listeners, when thinking about these ideas, to have a very skeptical attitude about the whole thing.
Yes, I think so. I think anyone who has listened to Alan, I mean, one name I want to be sure to say is Patrick Wood, because Alan, we've cited to Patrick Wood's Technocracy News and read his book Technocracy Rising and mentioned that, and he really has been he's laid out the technocracy agenda very well many years ago and has been sounding the alarm on this. And this is where we are. And I don't think that people I have new listeners that come in all the time and people write to me and say they only discovered Alan's work after he passed away, et cetera. So I know there are newer listeners and people who say that they began to see that something was wrong around Operation C, but long-time listeners are going to know that to Alan's mind, the end game was technocratic control. This is total control, cradle to grave, total surveillance, bio-digital. Well, on page 5, and I'm struck by this, I say it all the time, but on page 5 of the first volume of his Cutting Through books, he wrote, "This is the final phase of humanity as we know it." Now, he said, does that sound extreme? Well, then go back to your television. So he's sounding a very loud alarm that unless we do something, this is what is happening. Because as you and your colleagues in this work have pointed out, transhumanism is not an exciting, augmented, enhanced transhuman. It is post-human.
Yes, and I think Alan was way ahead of the curve on this one, but I would second everything that you have just said there. The plans here are for total domination. They want to have total control over your life. And they intend to do this through biodigital technologies. And so we already see the social credit scoring system in China. And, you know, what this means, for example, is if you behave in the wrong way or you hold the wrong views, in inverted commas, you might find that you can't get the mortgage rates you want, or you can't get your children to the school that you want, or perhaps worse. And when we think about the central bank digital currency agenda, well, just think about the implications for what that would mean if we move to an all-digital financial system with no cash, whereby you have a digital wallet which is controlled by the central bank. Well, no longer do we have the split-circuit money system that John Titus has described in his work, which is essential to the democratic principle of no taxation without representation. No longer do we have money as a free means of exchange and transaction. Instead, what we have is a digital totalitarian control system whereby the central bank can decree that you can only spend your money, really it's tokens at this point, on certain products or in certain places at certain times. In other words, it can impose conditions. In principle, it could turn your money supply off altogether, making it more or less impossible to transact in society. So these are very clear, known directions of travel. The Bank for International Settlements head, Augustin Carstens, in 2020 openly talked in these terms about being able to impose conditionalities upon the way the tokens are spent. So we can see all of this already. And then when we attach the bio aspect to this and the possibility of connecting human beings up to this technocratic control grid, again, they try to market it in terms of convenience. You know, isn't it wonderful that you could just wave your chipped hand over the sensor, you know, the grocery store, and, you know, it will pay, and you don't risk losing your money or your wallet or anything like this, and it's all completely private. However, if they are successful in hooking everybody up to the internet, then they will have direct control over your bodies. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, like remote control robots where they can, you know, make you raise your right arm in the air, or, you know, anything like that per se. But it does mean that they'll be able to monitor you right down to the molecular level. They'll have knowledge about the inner workings of your body. There'll be no more privacy. They'll know where you are at all times and what you're doing. They could potentially use it to trigger adverse processes within the body, which could be used for purposes of inducing pain and suffering, or maybe even torture and assassination. The purposes really are, the possibilities rather, are endless, and they are frightening, and they're far worse than anything that Hitler or Stalin could have envisaged.
While you're on this, if you want to just keep going a little bit with some of the technology. Now, I know that this may not be your field, but you have written about it and accessed it. The technologies that you see that are already in use in this mechanism, because I like to talk about this as something that's here. This isn't coming. It is here.
Yes, it is. And I suppose the obvious starting point is the medical literature and the electronic communications literature around the internet of bio nano things. I mean, this is an extensive literature now, and it talks quite openly about how really two things are required in particular. One is to be able to get certain nano components into the body which are capable of self-assembling and communicating with an external network. But in order to do that, the other component is synthetic biology and programming human bodies and human cells to produce items, structures, which are not natural to the human body, but which are essential to the process of building this intracorporeal nano network. So again, in that context, it's really troubling when you look at the work that some brave microscopists and spectroscopists have done regarding the contents of the so-called vaccine, COVID vaccine vials, as well as the blood of vaccinated and unvaccinated patients. And they're finding some truly frightening things. In particular, I was on a call last week with David Nixon and Carl Koronis, who have been devoting their lives, actually, for several years now, to trying to get to the bottom of what this stuff is. And they told me that since August 2023, they haven't seen any, they've been looking at, I think they said, over 120 people's blood over the last 15 months or so, or longer. But since August 2023, they haven't seen any blood that they consider resembled just ordinary blood before all of this injection business began. And what's even more disturbing about what they have to say is that it's not just so-called vaccinated blood that is displaying these peculiar structures and contaminations. It's also unvaccinated blood. And so Koronis's own blood work is a mess. He's shown it on his Substack, and it's full of all kinds of peculiar looking structures, including what he calls multi-lamellar structures, which they're not bubbles, but they appear kind of bubble-like under the microscope. And the reason you can tell that they're not bubbles, well, one of several reasons, is that they contain apparently a kind of colloidal substance, collection of lipids, and structures which actually start to assemble within the multilamellar structure. And this is all going on in the blood. And there have been countless reports of particularly the ribbon-like structures, which appear, kind of things appear to kind of bubble off these ribbon-like structures. So for anyone paying attention, there's some pretty serious questions to be asked about what this stuff is, what's really going on with the so-called vaccines. A recent paper published, I think, just last week, showed using advanced-level spectroscopy that the COVID vaccines, over half a dozen different manufacturers, incidentally, contain no fewer than 55 elements that were not disclosed in the ingredients, including most heavy metals. So what's that all about? Again, we've clearly not been told the truth. And as I argue in my 2022 paper called What is in the COVID-19 Vaccines? Evidence of a Global Crime Against Humanity, I bring together the findings of 26 different researchers and research teams across the world in that paper. And what becomes abundantly clear is that whatever this stuff is, the public wasn't told about it. And there's all kinds of stuff in there which shouldn't be there, which means that there was no possibility of informed consent, which means that this was a worldwide violation of the Nuremberg Code, which means that essentially a global medical experiment of kinds has just been carried out on billions of people. And that's the horrific reality that we appear to be facing.
I printed that paper out. It's about 130 pages, but I encourage people not to be the least bit intimidated by the length of it, because it's full of pictures. And these images are fascinating. Just to study it and say, wow, that's, find an old textbook from, say, the 50s. Give yourself a, or the 60s, give yourself a blood slide to look at and then compare it to what you're looking at in the blood that's being studied now, it's very different.
And experienced hematologists, for example, when they saw some of these images, said they'd never seen anything like this in decades of experience before the injection rollout. And of course, the nefarious CAMP2 figures are very, very keen to say, oh no, you know, this self-assembling nanotech is, it's all nonsense. And, you know, it's just salt and cholesterol crystals and things like this. And there was an interesting phenomenon, shall we say, a few weeks ago when my co-author, Daniel Brody, he co-authored a paper with a scientist that we've known for a few years now, called Young-Mi Lee in South Korea.
I read that and I cited to it I posted it on the website a couple of times to point it out to people.
Good, because what Young-Mi has done is the longest and most comprehensive longitudinal study of the vaccine contents, looking at how they behave over long periods of time. And again, all kinds of findings which you would not expect based on the disclosed ingredients. And the authors in that case conclude that it's entirely possible that we're looking at some form of nanotechnology. Now, no sooner had this paper come out than there was a coordinated attack on the authors. And again, I refer back here to the kind of tactics that were used against Amazing Polly last year. All kinds of abuse and smears over social media. A huge ruckus created about this. The authors received personal threats. So what's causing all of this? And I can only assume it's because they are in fact over the target. They are exposing classified technology which was intended to remain hidden. And it's the same kind of tactics that we've seen many times, for example, in the persecution of Andrew Wakefield to stop any questioning of vaccines, in the persecution of Judy Wood to stop anyone looking properly at the evidence regarding the destruction of the Twin Towers. And here we have very similar tactics being used against these authors to try and intimidate and dissuade anybody else from asking these kinds of questions. But one of the most extraordinary images presented in that paper is, I think, of the contents of a Moderna vial. And it had been under the microscope for, or the sample rather, was 32 days old. And a few kind of filaments and ribbons and so on had started to appear from nowhere during that time, which is fairly common for these substances. However, that sample was then exposed to EMF, and within 1 hour, all kinds of substances had proliferated all across the slide. Now, this is primary empirical evidence, and we have to ask, why would the contents of a Moderna vial be responsive to EMF radiation? Because salt and cholesterol crystals are not responsive. And so we're seeing quite a large push at the moment to try and discredit the nanotech idea. And that is why I am pushing back hard in the opposite direction.
What is interesting about this CAMP2 and CAMP1 push against this is that this technology is known. It's all over mainstream literature and peer-reviewed papers. The origami mRNA, for example, this technology is written about. I only discovered it recently. I was fascinated by this RNA origami, and then I saw that you had written about it already in your paper on transhumanism. But this is something that is delivered, and when it's delivered already in your body, then it folds itself, allows the RNA to fold itself into different shapes. They're using this all the time. I mean, they're experimenting with it. They're using it. They, you know, they say, oh, it's a new application, but this is being studied and tested. And we're supposed to believe that it's not possible. It's not even conceivable that this would be in the vaccines that have already, the experimental injections that have already been delivered to us.
That's right. It's acceptable to say we are developing these kinds of technologies for healthcare purposes. And no one has a problem with that. What's not acceptable is to suggest that those same technologies may already have been weaponized against the public or may conceivably be weaponized against the public in the future, despite all of the military intelligence literature that is linked to this. And we can even go beyond the academic literature and look at policy. And if you look, for example, at the Policy Horizons Canada document from 2020 on transhumanism, or if we look at Joe Biden's executive order from September 2022, we find in both cases that these documents are referring openly to bioengineering and, quote, predictably managing human biology, end quote. So what do they mean by that? Predictably managing human biology. So this is no longer in the kind of theoretical or planning stage as it was in the early 2000s. It's gone beyond the technological realization and feasibility aspects of the 2010s. And it's now moved into the policy arena. So if anybody thinks that this kind of technology isn't coming for them, they might want to take another look at this.
Well, I am interested in hearing anything that you might want to say on the chapter that I couldn't finish last night, which was chapter 8, Becoming Unrest. Is it fresh enough in your mind to?
Yes, I suppose. So the thrust of the book is that we are in World War III, which is waged by the aggressors to roll out technocracy on a global scale. That is the war aim. It's an undeclared war. It's a clandestine war. And it's what I call an omni-war, which is to say a war that is waged across every domain of human life against the public, but in ways that are designed so that the public doesn't recognize it as such. So if you keep your eyes on my Substack and on the Soleri report, I have a long report coming out in the next few weeks on the Omni-War, and you can find a lot more about it there. Now, when we get to chapter 8, it kind of begs the question of where all of this is going. And already during the COVID era, we saw mass resistance by millions of people marching against the measures in country after country after country, and very memorably with the Freedom Convoy in Canada, which really highlighted the level of public support for the resistance. And so it brings us to a situation where the ruling class, the technocrats, they have no choice now but to press on with this. As I argue in my Omni-War presentation in the symposium, they themselves have decided that the previous control system before COVID was no longer fit for purpose, and they are trying to institute this new biodigital slavery system. So they themselves are dismantling the old system bit by bit. It's a kind of form of controlled demolition, and they are trying to gradually roll out the new system while maintaining control at all times. The trouble is, in times of war, there is tremendous potential for change. And so I argue that we're living in an interregnum at the moment, where the old control system is no longer deemed fit for purpose, the new control system is not yet fully implemented, and therefore for things could go in all manner of different directions. But what is certain is that the resistance to these technocratic agendas is going to grow, and it's going to grow rapidly and in proportion to the number of people who understand what is happening. So this is the coming unrest that I refer to in the title. We cannot maintain the status quo. And I think we're on the brink of a major historical turning point or inflection, where something will happen globally, which will either accelerate the path to technocracy, or will significantly derail those agendas and lead in other directions. So all of this begs the question, given that the Omniwar is a war that is waged by the few against the many, how can they hope to win? Well, obviously, they are reliant on technological superiority. Klaus Schwab even says this in his COVID-19 book. The line is something like, the COVID crisis could tip the balance in favor of labor against capital, but for technological reasons, that seems very unlikely. And so what technology are they referring to here? And it's the kind of technologies which we've been discussing during this conversation. So in the book, I argue that the understanding that there would be this global class war eventually goes back to at least the mid 20th century. The understanding that they would need to develop the requisite technologies to roll out technocracy again can be traced back decades. The planning for this goes back an awful long way. The military intelligence literature that I've described goes back to at least the year 2000. I think the planning for the psychological operation again goes back to a similar time period. All of the pandemic preparation preparedness acts and exercises and so on go back at least as far as Operation Dark Winter in 2001. So all of this has been long in incubation, and now it's suddenly upon us. And so again, in that context, the ruling class must have known for a long time that it was going to initiate this undeclared war, that numerically the odds are stacked against it, that it has to achieve superiority and dominance through technological means. And when you look at it that way, there is a war logic behind using injections, for example, to create this internet of bio-nano things, this internet of bodies. And that's why we have to take very seriously now the idea that injections are not so much about healthcare as they are about the military. So it's kind of an open-ended chapter, really, to conclude the book, because I don't have a crystal ball and I can't tell you where exactly this is all going to go. But one thing I do highlight in that chapter is the desperation and the urgency of the transnational ruling class. There were many aspects of the COVID operation which were botched. Lots of people are waking up very quickly now, and I think that they are in a position of real jeopardy, and you can hear that in their voices and in their statements at forums like Davos and elsewhere. And I think that, contrary to a fairly widespread pessimism and demoralization which has been deliberately instigated among the resistance, shall we call it, through the psychological operations, I think that there is a real positive moment and possibility for change here that could well go in the direction of the people. All that's required is mass non-compliance with technocratic agendas, civil disobedience where appropriate, and rejection of smart technologies, suspicion and challenging, certainly of all biodigital technologies. Technocracy becomes unenforceable under those conditions. So I think that there is, in fact, tremendous reason for hope. And I conclude the book by saying that once all of this is said and done, we need to hold the perpetrators and instigators of atrocity to account.
I certainly do. One thing that I like to stress with people is that sense of urgency and a sense of a short window of time here. So I want to be gentle, but we've moved past the point of saving the Republic. This is global in scale, and people have to move a little bit faster in their thinking processes, if that is possible, so that you are looking at what is really happening to the best of your ability. And like you just said, I don't have a crystal ball either, so I don't know how it plays out, but I do know that things are moving very quickly. And so when I hear people who are still seeking out the political solution or the, you know, saving the Republic solution, I wince a little bit and want to try to help them see the urgency of the situation.
I agree completely with that. I think the solution cannot be found at the political or the legal level. It can only be found at the social level. It cannot be found at the national level. It can only be found at the global level. And I share your sentiments about the urgency now of taking action to oppose these technocratic agendas, because there is a time frame, in fact, in place, and it has been in place since the turn of the millennium. When you look, for instance, at the NASA 2001 document, I think it's called Strategic Futures, Future Warfare, circa 2025. And that document sets out a timeline whereby what it calls the IT bio-nano era will begin in 2020. Well, I think that's largely what the COVID operation was intended to initiate. Mm-hmm. It said, it lists all kinds of technologies, which it claims are, quote, no pixie dust, end quote, things which in 2001 would have sounded completely unbelievable. But already this NASA document, which was not intended for public release, was claiming in no uncertain terms that these technologies are in fact feasible and achievable. And it says that the normal time frame for getting them developed is about 15 years. So what do we see in 2015? The announcement of smart dust technology, which is one of the technologies it mentioned, and also the Internet of Bio Nano Things in the seminal 2015 paper by Professor Ian Akiyildiz. So that matches as well. There was a document by a consortium called Proteus, a transnational consortium involving governments and international organizations and others, from 2008, which sketched a very similar timeline. And it saw a major transition in 2020, led up to by a period of rolling pandemics. So they were already thinking along those lines back in 2008. We have Gates's decade of the vaccine, announced in 2010. The very last day of Gates's decade of the vaccine was the 31st of December 2019, which was the same day that the first cases of the alleged novel coronavirus were reported to the WHO. So there's a sense in which all of this appears to be planned very much to a timeline. 2030, of course, is the year that they keep beating us around the head with, not just with Agenda 2030, but every international organization has set targets for 2030. But I'll come back again to this NASA document from 2001 and its title, Future Warfare Circa 2025. Mm-hmm. We are now a few months away from 2025. Mm-hmm. And so if this has indeed been planned with military precision, we could be looking at a period of global warfare involving all kinds of technologies which the public probably doesn't even believe to be possible, happening before we know it. So it is about time that people take very seriously now what is going on, because human freedom itself is now on the line.
Yes, I agree with that urgency. You're talking about the timeline there, and one document that we've had on the website for years is the DCDC Global Strategic Trends Program from 2007 to 2036. Mm-hmm. And this is one that Alan mentioned often. It's the Directorate General within the UK's Ministry of Defense. And this talks about global unrest, widespread unrest amongst the civilian population, and their anticipation of it. And so the question is, why?
Mm. You know. Indeed. And one of the things I closed the book, in fact, it might even be the last paragraph of my COVID book, has to do with civil war and planning for civil war, which can be traced back, in fact, to the continuity of governance arrangements in the United States, which actually go all the way back to the 1950s, but particularly with the establishment of FEMA in the 1970s. And there does appear to me to be deliberate attempts now to stoke social tensions all across the West. You know, the alleged assassination attempt against Trump, the first one, mm-hmm. When he gets up, and of course it's all kind of staged for propaganda purposes with the flag and so on. But what's the first thing he does? Puts his fist in the air and says, fight, fight, fight.
Mm-hmm. You know, I have to say something, that I looked at that again just a couple of days ago, and for a brief moment that fist was relaxed and it was just the hand straight up in the air. What does that look like?
Yes, indeed.
That was quite interesting. I have taken up a lot of your time, and I appreciate the generosity with which you have shared it and all of your insights and work. And there are just a couple of things that I want to mention before I let you go, and then anything else that you want to say, of course. I want to let people know that you have a Substack that at the moment is where your work is primarily housed, and that is dhughes.substack.com. And then you are building a website, which I just went to yesterday and saw it's in progress, and that is davidahughes.net. The first volume of the book that we've been discussing, COVID-19, Psychological Operations and the War for Technocracy, Volume 1. That full book is available on your Substack for download. And I know that the Wall Street, the Nazis, and the Crimes of the Deep State, I don't have that, but I've heard from a couple of listeners that they have purchased that and they are diving in. And then you said that part 2 of the first book is coming. And so I wanted to find out what the focus will be and when you anticipate having that ready.
Thank you. Yeah, those are indeed the best websites to go to. I set my davidahughes.net website up about 4 months ago. There's almost nothing on it at the moment, which is a reflection of how busy I've been producing the content, which is available on the Substack. Yeah, so in terms of Volume 2, so COVID-19 Psychological Operations and the War for Technocracy, Volume 1, was published in April with Palgrave Macmillan, and I was able to attract £14,000 of open access funding for that work, all of which went to the publisher. But the good news is that even though the hard copies are very expensive, and I don't receive a penny from hard copy sales, the ebook is available for free under a Creative Commons 4.0 license. And so anybody can download that and legally redistribute it with the relevant attribution. And that's all good, and I would encourage you to do so. We've talked a bit about academia during this conversation. After 11 years of full-time continuous employment in academia, I left on the 1st of September. So I no longer have an academic career, and my research at this point is now 100% dependent on public support. So please do support me if you can. There's a list of options at davidahughes.net/support. And one of the things that I'm trying to do during this next 12 months is to finish writing volume 2. So the COVID book was always intended as a 2-volume book, which in and of itself should help you to appreciate the level of complexity and planning and sheer malice behind that psychological operation, that a 400-page book published in April only covers half of it. I had to draw the distinction between the two volumes somewhat heuristically, and the way I did it was in volume 1, in terms of the psychological techniques used, I'm looking mostly at what Jost Merlo in the 1950s called menticide, or the rape of the mind. George Orwell wrote about how true power is being able to take a mind to pieces and then put it back together again. Mm. And that's exactly the kind of techniques which were being used during the MK Ultra program, also in the 1950s and 1960s. So volume 1 looks very much at the destructive elements of this, the attacks on the mind, the means of keeping people in, you know, states of shock and trauma and stress and fear, and so on.
I just want to
social division.
Mm. I want to interject here too that you have been quite willing to examine. You've been willing to go places that I don't think other academics would go, and that includes covering things that have to do with ritual abuse and the kind of trauma that happens around that. And you know, that's one of those subjects that people get a little freaked out about, but you've looked at the documentation there and made some interesting conclusions.
That's right. That's mostly in chapter 3 of volume 1. And you're right. I mean, these are subjects which academics just won't touch. They won't go there. There's no chance of getting any truth on these issues from academia, unfortunately, which is one of the key reasons why I left. But you have to understand these really dark, evil ritualistic practices, and you have to understand how methods of psychological control, which were developed on individuals in the first half of the 20th century, came to be applied to groups and eventually entire societies moving forwards through time. So if you don't know the history of how all of this has been done, you won't be able to understand how these mechanisms work in the present. So volume 2 is more about the, I don't want to call it positive, but positive in inverted commas, programming of the human mind once it's been taken to pieces. You know, this is Orwell's, you know, putting it back together again. So I'm interested here in terms of cult indoctrination, for example, hypnosis, obedience training, and all of the ways of getting people to do what you want, applied behavioral psychology, for instance. You talked earlier about kind of the primitive aspect of human nature, and Hitler knew in 1924 in Mein Kampf that people can be controlled by what he called the primitive mind. And we see similar ideas actually in applied behavioral psychology in terms of what they call the automatic brain and how to control people's automatic brain so you can get them to do things without them even consciously realizing they're being manipulated. So that is the unpleasant flavor of volume 2. Now, I'd put in place about a 12-month time frame to get this done kind of back in the late spring, early summertime. It might be a bit longer than that now because the good news is there's been a lot of interest actually in my work and in my research. The public has very kindly contributed all kinds of links and leads and information. And what this has meant is that over the summer, my research has kind of led to places involving electromagnetic warfare, further development of the omni-war concept, further investigations of transhumanism and nanotech and so on, which I think they deserved to be prioritized because we need some serious research into these things. So that's kind of put me behind by a few months, but I'm still intending to get volume two finished. But realistically now, it's probably going to be around 12 months from now, so probably early autumn next year. But I'm going as fast as I can, so please bear with me.
Well, I heard you mention in an interview a couple of months back that you weren't at liberty to talk about your leaving. You had been a lecturer at Lincoln University, but are you able to say in any way, even cryptically, if your lines of inquiry had anything to do with the end of your academic career?
I can't get into the individual details of my case, but I can talk about the general principle that I don't believe that asking the kinds of questions that I ask in my research, addressing taboo topics, speaking truth to power in a meaningful way, all of which are necessary for the good of society, I don't believe that these things are actually possible in the context of academia. I think there are very insidious mechanisms at work within the profession, which again I'll get into in more detail in my upcoming series on this. And it was therefore with a certain degree of peace that I chose to leave the profession, because the whole reason I went into it in the first place was a love of the truth, and a desire to follow the truth wherever it might lead. And this is supposed to be what academic freedom is all about. But unfortunately, what's become very clear to me is that academic freedom doesn't exist in that sense, that there are actually very firmly prescribed limits beyond which your thinking must not go. So in order to continue my journey and pursuit of the truth, paradoxically, I have decided it's necessary to leave academia, which is a remarkable thing given the lengths I went to and the dedication and the sacrifices I made to get that career and to develop it. And it was all going well, but here we are. So life sometimes can be unexpected.
Yes. Well, I am so appreciative of your time. I was really looking forward to this. Like I said, it was a little bit like, water in the desert to say, oh, look, maybe there are genuine people. And I like the camp three concept because it gets very lonely sometimes, and you like to know that there are other people out there who are aware of the stakes and are working very, very hard to do something about it and turn it around. I wanted to mention just one thing before we close, and that is I've just launched something. I've done my first installment, or I may have done two now, of something that I'm calling Real History Shorts, where I have a recording of, say, 10 or 12 minutes with someone. They could even be shorter than that, 5 minutes, that I might put out midweek, because I talk to a lot of interesting people, and I find that they don't have time, or I don't have time to do an hour or more. And so if there is anything that you feel you just want to do like a 5-minute talk or rant on, I would be happy to record that and you know, kind of bring things to people's attention as you go in your research.
That's a great idea. And, I mean, people do still value long form content, which is good to see, but it's also an undeniable fact that many people are time pressured. Attention spans are quite short. And actually that would be a very effective way of reaching people.
Yeah. So if I'm hopeful that you'll want to come back in a longer setting as you have time, but I also wanted to put out there that I'm doing this, and so we can communicate and see if there's something that you just want to say 10 minutes on something. And then I want to say again to listeners, I'm kind of what I do with whatever I'm doing. I'll put out 20 links or 50, and I'll say, read this book and look at that. And I expect people to do it. So I don't know if they do. You know, I know we all are short on time, but I put it there because I think it's worthwhile. And so I will link to quite a few things that I've been able to look at of your work, and then a few things that I haven't gotten to yet. And that will go up with this talk. And then I just wanted to say, imparting to you, Foundations, Their Power and Influence. It's written by Renee Wormser, Wormser. I highly recommend it to you. I think you will find it eye-opening, and it could contribute to your Volume 2 work.
Well, thank you very much for the tip. One of the great joys of doing this work is constantly finding these new sources and avenues of investigation. So I'm very grateful for that, and I'm very grateful for the chance to have been with you today. It's been a real pleasure, and please do reach out at any time, and I'd be very happy to come on again in future.
Oh, I appreciate that, and thank you so much. And I know listeners have been looking forward to this, so we're all happy that you were able to do this, and I thank you again.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Something that the world didn't give me, and the world cannot take it.